Welcome to A Better Peace, podcast of the U.S. Army War College official online journal War Room, graciously supported by the Army War College Foundation. Please join the conversation at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. We hope you enjoy the program. The views expressed in this presentation are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of the U.S. Army War College, U.S. Army, or Department of War. Make sure not to miss a single episode and subscribe to A Better Peace, the War Room podcast, at warroom.armywarcollege.edu/subscribe.
Welcome to A Better Peace, the War Room podcast. I'm Dr. Tom Sparr, Desario Chair of Strategic and Theater Intelligence at the U.S. Army War College, and your host for today's conversation. Here at the Army War College, we study, discuss, and teach about the ongoing war in Ukraine, attempting to glean lessons about the future of warfare. But to really understand the war, we must first understand the two sides. Today, we will focus primarily on Russia and specifically the Russian intelligence services, which play a critical role in Russia's global engagement. I've been fortunate over the last year to develop a relationship with an expert on Russian culture and its Russian intelligence services, which are generally made up of three organizations: the SVR, or Russian Foreign Intelligence Service, the GRU, which is the Military Intelligence Directorate, and the FSB, the Federal or Internal Security Service, of which Vladimir Putin was once the leader. Our guest today in the War Room virtual studio is Mr. Sean Wiswesser, a Russian expert with over 30 years of experience as a national security and intelligence professional. Mr. Wiswesser is a fluent Russian linguist who began studying Russian at the age of 13 and attended multiple Russian universities as an exchange student before joining the Federal Service and being stationed in the former Soviet Union across Eastern Europe, living over 12 years overseas. Sean was a senior operations officer with the CIA, serving as a chief of station and also in war zones. Naval Institute Press will publish his book titled Tradecraft, Tactics, and Dirty Tricks: Russian Intelligence and Putin's Secret War, in April 2026. Sean spoke to one of my classes last year, and I had the good fortune to review his book for Parameters, a journal of the U.S. Army War College. Sean also authored a chapter in a recent U.S. Army War College press publication called A Call to Action, Lessons from Ukraine for the Future Force, among many other articles and essays on Russia and Russian intelligence services. Sean's asked me to mention that his opinions are his own and not that of the CIA or any of the U.S. government. With that, Sean, welcome to the War Room studio.
Well, thank you, Tom. It's an honor to be with you and your listeners, all the more so since I had joint duty assignments in my career. I was privileged to serve with military counterparts. I myself attended Air War College. So great to be with your listeners, and I have tremendous respect for all of you that have served and continue to serve. So thanks for having me.
Hey, attended Air War College, you're publishing with the Navy, and you also publish with the Army, and you're podcasting with the Army. So you are the joint forces, right? From the interagency. That's terrific.
Trying to hit them all.
Hey, so let's just start with why. You know, what motivated you really to write this book about the Russian intelligence services?
Yeah, thank you for the question, Tom. It's a good one. You know, everybody has an idea. I think a lot of professionals, whatever field you may have worked in, you have an idea of a book. And someone once told me that profound advice, you know, if you're going to write a book, write the book that only you could write, so it's interesting for others. Well, so the idea of the book, I was always a tradecraft expert. I retired as a member of a senior expert cadre in the director of operations. That's in the bio in my book. CIA cleared me to be able to say that. And my focus was on tradecraft, what we call denied area tradecraft in particular, that I talk about in my book. So I always had an interest in that over my decades in the intelligence community and with CIA. So that's the idea. But then there's the reality. Writing a book is really hard. It's a lot harder than I thought, to be honest with you. And so then as my career was kind of winding down, I attended Air War College. And before I attended War College, I will say, I don't think I believed I could really do it, that I could write an entire book. I had written, you know, short stories. I was always interested in fiction. I'd written some articles. But War College gave me the confidence to do it. I want to mention that at Air War College, Dr. Doug Pfeiffer, Dr. John Torino, and Liz Woodworth, who I now think is still at Army War College, Liz inspired me to write, and they all worked with me on my writing. And then there was Dr. John Noggle from Army War College, the project you mentioned. He reached out to see if anybody was working on the Ukraine war, and I was working on a thesis on the failure of Russian air power in the Ukraine war. So John helped me get that published, my thesis, and he included me in his book. And then what I owe John Noggle for is, as we came to a conclusion with that project, he said, now you can write your book on an intelligence. And I kind of laughed it off. He said, no, seriously, you should write a book. And so all of those professors and others helped me, but I really am in John Noggle's debt for believing in me and telling me, no, you really should go write a book about Russian intelligence. And he's been a supporter of it all along. So that's the not only the motivation, but then how it sort of started to come to fruition.
What a great tribute to the effect that War College or that senior professional military education can have on someone with it. Clearly a gift like you have for writing to really bring it out. So thank you for highlighting that. One of the things I found really valuable about the book is the blend of sources you employed, you know, including a lot of your own personal experience. Can you just talk a little bit about that, how you sourced the book and what you enjoyed most about that process and perhaps what was most challenging in sourcing a work on intelligence like this?
Yeah, there's a number of challenges, Tom. I think that So the toughest one that I was keenly aware of from the start was, how am I going to get CIA to clear off on this book on tradecraft? And I needed to make the focus, and the focus is and was in the book, always on the Russians' tradecraft. So I knew that I was going to have to write the book in such a way as to show CIA a lot of this is already out there. I'm just adding my analysis. And then the second part of the book was adding in some lived experience that, unbeknownst to me, many of my advanced readers, and I think you mentioned yourself, Tom, that's what they enjoyed the most, is some of my experiences I shared with Russian intelligence officers. But the first part of the book, when I really did the early drafts, I was focused on heavy citations. You know, I think there's 270 citations in the 200 plus page book. That was also in part for readers to enjoy and understand later. I had to show CIA a lot of this is out there. This is unclassified. They did work with me. It was not easy. It's an extra burden that an intelligence writer has, I think, just a little bit of a preview of what that's like. You know, I had to go through multiple drafts, but they worked with me. CIA helped me in the end. I appreciated their being willing to work with me, but that added a lot of on the timeline. John Noggle and some others actually told me, hey, you need more stories in this book. So the part two of my drafting was adding in stories of lived experience with Russian intelligence officers and trying to place them throughout the book. And I've been very honored that a lot of the readers have said that's some of the most interesting parts, is where I have the history, I have the doctrine, I have a lot of other sources and books, but then I bring in my own experience working with intelligence, Russian intelligence officers of all three of those services across my career. One final thing, Tom, I'll mention, I got help along the way. I had Eric Leffler, experienced FBI professional, help me. My good friend from CIA, Greg Sims, helped me. Kevin Relay was another professor now in the UK, former FBI DIA. And then I just want to mention Mike Sulik. He's a former deputy director of operations from CIA and a former boss of mine and all of us. I asked him if he'd be willing to write the foreword of the book, and he told me, only if I like it, if you did a good enough job. I think he kind of said that to me, as all good bosses do, because he wanted to challenge me. So I'm in all of their debt for their help, and Mike helped inspire me to finish it even better as a book, and he wrote a very gracious foreword. So honored to have all of them that helped me.
Put a little pressure on you
He did a very, very nice foreword to the book.
Yeah, it's great that you mentioned some friends there, and you do, you know, you use some stories from friends, some vignettes from friends that are out there, and they're great. They just add so much depth to it. It's really deep in your experience, friends' experiences. It brings together a lot of spy journals, even a little bit of fiction that you mix in there that lends some credence, because some fiction is based on things that actually happen, right, in the real world. So, you know, when we write intelligence and history, I feel like we end up doing a lot of myth busting. And you definitely do this throughout the book. So what do you think is the most important myth that you busted about the Russian intelligence services?
Yeah, I set out to be accurate, truthful, and to try to give the background history of the Russian intelligence services, but I also wanted to break down this image in the media that, and it's portrayed in movies, a lot of movies, you know, the bad guys are always 10 feet tall and the Russian intelligence service, oh, the KGB, you know, now the SVR, FSB, they're so good at what they do. Actually, they're not. In a lot of the ways, they're not, and they haven't been. Over the course of my career, I saw them for who they are, and we CIA officers, my colleagues and I, we know Putin and his chinovniki, his bureaucrats, and the Chekisti, as the Russians call themselves, you know, the Chekists after the Cheka, the first security service after the revolution. They take pride in calling themselves that. These are murderers. These are thugs. And I try to get in a lot of that history, Tom, as you know, reading the book. I want to portray them for who they are. And I also want to show their corruption that is so endemic to everything they do. One of the stories I relate in the book, you'll recall, even at their training academy, at the very start of their career, one intelligence officer related to me the experience I share in the book. He was told that they couldn't use their cars for vehicular surveillance exercises. I asked him, well, why not? Why can't you use the cars? That's really important for surveillance training. No. The instructors keep those for them and their girlfriends on the weekends, so they take all the gas. I mean, how telling is that? Even at the very start of their careers, they're told to deal with corruption, get used to it. You got to go along with it. And then the other aspect to just sharing, you know, again, about who they really are. You know, the Russians intelligence services, they're plenty competent when they want to be, when they need to get things accomplished, but they're so riddled with a dishonesty. They can't be honest with themselves or their leadership or President Putin for that matter. And I know we'll talk about Ukraine later. That led them to disaster in Ukraine. So I wanted to portray them with all their flaws, with all their kinks, but also with a warning that we need to be on guard. We can't let up. We can't give in. We have to be ready for them, because many of the experiences I relate are their failures, but they have their successes too.
No, that's good. And you know what? Let's just go to Ukraine. And it's maybe even a little away from the book for a minute, because you have so much expertise on this. But before we go there, I want to ask you about the Russian people. It's clear from the book that you know and love the Russian people. You've spent a lot of time with them. But also that you disdain what you refer to as the darker forces in Russian society. So one of the things I struggle with, and I struggle to explain a little bit to our students, is how the Russian people continue to support what is clearly an unjust war, a blatant invasion of a sovereign Ukrainian territory, when the cost is so high for Russia. So how does Putin control the narrative and continue to convince the Russian people to support his deadly efforts in Ukraine?
Yeah, Tom, thank you for that question. It's a really important one. It's critically important right now, because I think most Americans have no concept of what is happening in Russia right now. What's it like in their society? What's the news like, the evening news in Russia? There's a great podcast recently started by CNI. A colleague I've gotten to know, Andy Cutchins, I would recommend check it out. It's called Russia Decoded. And he tries to go through with his fellow commentator, what does our news sound like every week? And you get a little bit of a glimpse just how strong the propaganda is in the Russian state right now in Russian media. There is absolutely no freedom of the press whatsoever, and there hasn't been for many years. In fact, to criticize the war in any way from the very get-go in 2022 is a state crime in Russia. So what you end up with is a completely propagandized version of history, where to the Russian people and in their media, NATO started this war. It's NATO troops in Ukraine attacking Russia. And it's in their news and their broadcasts. And all the time, it's about how, you know, CIA waged this war against Russia. Forget the fact that we tried to warn them and stop them. Forget the fact that, you know, the United States and our allies were very clear with Putin. We know what you're going to do. We tried to prevent what happened in 2014, which I talk about in my book as well. You know, the fact that we didn't speak up louder and protest stronger. So the in 2022, though, it was open for the whole world to see what was happening. You know, Russians are getting ready for a full-scale invasion of Ukraine. But in the Russian narrative, they were attacked. They were forced into this war. One small piece of the puzzle, Tom, but a very, very important one that Americans don't tend to focus on, World War II. So for us, that's 80 plus years ago. It's in the Russian news every single night. There's a reference. There's a talk about fascists. This is a war against fascism. We have to remember that for the Russian and Soviet people, World War II was such a scar on their society. My wife is Lithuanian. She's part Russian and Ukrainian. Her Russian-Ukrainian grandfather was a true hero on the front. He fought for 4 years on the front. He met his wife there. My wife's Russian grandmother. They met at the front. She was a battlefield nurse. On the other side, my wife had her great-grandfather was executed by the SS. Family stories like that across the Soviet Union and in Russia in particular are very common. So when the propaganda talks about what are false atrocities, or in 2014, for instance, when they claimed that a little boy was crucified in eastern Ukraine by fascist forces, complete propaganda, complete mythology, just falsehood, it gets a lot of run in Russia. It means something to those people because no one has ever forgotten World War II. There's a very important saying in Russia. They say, Никто не забыт, ничто не забыто. No one is forgotten, nothing is forgotten from World War II. So Putin and his intelligence services and the propagandized media that support them, they play heavily on this myth that they're fighting fascism just like World War II. And that's hard without any freedom of the press to break in and against that. Tom, it's very, very hard. So that's just a snapshot. We could talk for hours about right. that. But that's how difficult it is. That's what the Russians think is going on right now.
No, you nailed it. And, you know, I teach World War II a lot in class. And I say to my students all the time, hey, this is a part of the Russian culture. They lost 20 million people during that war. And that's just an estimate. We really will never have an accurate count. But so much more traumatic than our society experienced. And it is just ingrained in their culture and something that he can really play upon well.
Exactly, Tom. And to be clear, there's no excusing what the Russians did and are doing in Ukraine. We'll talk about Ukraine more, I know, later in this podcast. I'm all about we should be doing the maximum to support Ukraine in their fight for freedom. But it's understanding what led, you know, the Russians talk about mentalitet, their mentality, what led to them. They believe they're fighting a preventative war. It's not true, but it's hard to fight that very strong play that they make on World War II.
No, thanks for that. He's sticking with Ukraine a little bit, but kind of tying it back into the intelligence tradecraft. How have you seen Russia employ intelligence tradecraft, both in the early phases of the war in Ukraine, and then how do they continue to employ it today?
Yeah, thank you for that. Chapter 10 of the book, as you know, the final chapter is one of the largest. It's on the Ukraine war. It's a case study of how Russian intelligence how they planned the war and then how they conducted it. So a couple of key points in their planning and prognostications, utter failure, utter and complete failure. I hope that one day Russia will be free enough to write the history of how disastrous their prognostications were. The FSB in particular, as I talk about in the book, the FSB Fifth Service is responsible for intelligence reporting to the president. The FSB also answers within the intelligence structure of Russia. They answer for what they call the near abroad. And arrogantly, they've always referred to and believe Ukraine is the near abroad. Because remember, Putin and the security services, they don't consider Ukraine a country. That's part of what they went to war. If you recall Putin's speech prior to the war, he did everything in that long, winding speech to basically claim Ukraine's not a country, even though, of course, a Ukrainian identity existed even before Kiev and Rus, existed before the idea of the Moscow Rus. So I won't get into that long story. But anyway, FSB answered for the planning for the war on the intelligence side. And they were convincing President Putin that they could win and they would win. So much so that even Russian bloggers, and by the way, Russian bloggers, to read them in Russian, they've been one of the, it's not freedom of the press, but they've been putting things out on the internet they really shouldn't. One of the stories that leaked, you may remember reporting early in the war, was FSB senior officers and generals picking out what apartment blocks they plan to take over in Kiev, because they were so sure it would be a quick victory and a quick war. So their predictions were horribly wrong. I wrote my thesis, as I mentioned, on the Russian Air Force's failures. But the Russians were completely unprepared for a long war, and their intelligence services were woefully unprepared. Now, since then, Tom, part two, though, of what they've done in the war, unfortunately, the Russians have adapted, just like the Ukrainians. They've adapted very well in many respects. You know, you look at the standing up of the entire new element to their armed forces, the unmanned systems troops, VBS in Russian, they call themselves, and units like Rubicon, you know, they've turned this into a drone war. So they've adapted from a ground invasion that looked very much like, you know, kind of like World War II, Afghanistan, you know, in different respects, massed artillery trying to advance long columns. They transitioned it to a new type of war. Their intelligence services, some units have been entirely reconstituted, and we can talk more about that if you like. But so I think it's initial failure. There's been failures along the way, but there's also been adaptation on their side. And maybe in some respects, adaptation that NATO needs to keep up better with.
You know, you mentioned that it's another failure of the services of the front. And you were critical of Russian intelligence throughout the book and in this podcast, right? Yeah, justifiably so. Yet they're still a threat, right? So yeah, what do you assess is that greatest strength of the Russian intel services that our American service members, or our audience is our students here and you know, lieutenant colonel, colonels and above, what should they be aware of with the potential to face the Russian intelligence services?
Yeah, so let's talk about two strengths of the Russians, and I touch on these in my book. Let's talk about strategic and tactical. At the strategic level, the greatest threat to democracies worldwide, the greatest threat to freedom on a level, as you know, in the book, Tom, I make the comparison there. They are an existential threat to the United States and to our way of life, to freedom. The Russian security services are, along with their Chinese and counterparts and other adversaries. But the book's about the Russians. Active measures, what the Russians call aktivnye meropriyatiya, or their modern term, they say meropriyatiya sodeystvia. Active measures, or the new modern term they use, measures of support. What are they supporting? They're supporting their malign policies abroad. What they intend in intelligence active measures for, Tom, and they've done it for decades, going back through the Cold War and before the Cold War, since the Soviet Revolution, it's designed to project on their adversaries what Russia wants to accomplish. And through things like terms like reflexive control, refer to an old KGB doctrine, let's get our adversaries to do our work for us. If they can get their adversaries, countries in NATO, to be fighting politically among themselves, that's a huge win for the Russian Federation. And they're very, very good at it. And this is where election meddling comes into play. Not for any one particular party or candidate, but Russian intelligence meddling in our elections, in the British elections, and I cite both examples in the book, and other elections around the world. Why do they do that? Because they want to sow distrust in the process itself. That's what they're attacking. They're attacking the very concept of democracy. Because for Putin and his Siloviki, of course, in Russian means strong men, the heads of the security services and the armed forces, they can't stand democracy. They don't want functioning democracies. That's a threat to Putin and his regime. He's scared to death of democracy because he's seen what's happened on his borders. Places like Ukraine, when democracy prevailed, freedom prevailed, you have democratic leaders. They're not perfect, far from perfect. The Ukrainians know that. They have problems they need to solve. But so that's what Putin's afraid of. He's afraid of what, of course, were called the color revolutions. At the tactical level, one thing I wanted to just add on the tactical level, Tom, and I comment in the book complimenting them. The Russian services are very, very good at compartmentation, better than we could ever be in the West. They compartment cases like their penetrations of our services, Ames and Hansen. I compliment in this book, and Mr. Sulik, our DDO, he was glad. He told me, I remember when he was reading the book, I'm glad you mentioned compartmentation. The Russians do it very, very well. So it was very hard. It took 9 years to uncover Ames. And it took over 20 years for us to catch and uncover Robert Hansen's treachery from the FBI. So those two spies, CIA and FBI spies, they lasted as long as they did because the Russians compartment very well. They protected penetrations of governments. So those are things we need to be aware of. But yeah, I could talk about active measures for hours, but there's a good chapter in the book, chapter 9. I hope the listeners will enjoy it.
All right, I'm going to give it all away. The one thing I do want you to talk about related to active measures, which when I describe active measures, I say they're roughly akin to COVID. Covert action in the United States or intelligence activities with political ends. And that's, you know, that's a rough interpretation. But, you know, you discuss in there the mafia-like assassination campaigns that the Russian intelligence forces conduct, both internally and across Europe and elsewhere. Yet they've been relatively muted in that in the United States. But can you just tell us a little bit about how they do those assassination campaigns? Is this something that we in the U.S. should be concerned about in the future?
Chapter 8 in the book touches on Russian special operations. So aktivnye meropriyatiya, those are information operations. What the Russians call pramoye deystvie is direct actions, okay? Or what they also call mokrye dela, or wet work. So there's a long tradition. I wrote an article for the Cypher Brief. I started a column a couple months ago. Hope some of your listeners might enjoy checking that out. I wrote an article called The Kremlin's Kill List, and I elaborated more on what I talk about in the book. There's a culture within the Russian intelligence services of direct action, as they call it, assassination and wet work. And it's long been a part of their services, dating back to the revolution. Russian intelligence services were always willing to kill for their leadership. Unfortunately, now, though, under Putin in particular, it's reached a new low, as it were, because there seems to be no accountability. You know, I use the analogy in the article I just mentioned, I wrote recently, and in the book I talk about this. This mafia-like culture of the Russian intelligence services means that they're always trying to impress the boss, meaning Putin. And so what I think is happening, in some cases he orders assassinations directly, I believe, Tom, my personal opinion. In the case of intelligence defectors, he and other leadership have made it clear they don't hide that. And he's talked about that openly. Medvedev, his former prime minister, said recently on one of the assassinations that killed a Russian helicopter pilot in Spain, he said, well, a dog deserves a dog's death, doesn't he? So they don't really hide that.
It's almost a part of their strategy, right?
Like, yeah, it's a part of
that intimidation.
They want that intimidation. But in other cases, I do think that the intelligence services just have no supervision anymore, and they're very reckless. They're doing it to impress the boss, much like a smaller figure in an organization wants to get his button. I think you have different elements within the GRU, FSB, in particular, trying to impress Putin, and they're just getting more and more reckless. I think we do need to be worried about it in the United States, Tom, to the final point of your question. A few years ago, this has been reported on by the New York Times, allegedly, according to the Times, there was an attempt by the Russians to kill a defector living in the States here. And I personally believe that there's a lot more of that we're not uncovering right now. There was the attempt by the Russians last year, the GRU, to kill Rheinmetall CEO in Germany that the Germans foiled. So again, I think they're at a new low in terms of their recklessness and lack of accountability. At least during the Cold War, we thought there was some accountability within the KGB and GRU, but not anymore, unfortunately.
Okay, I want to come back to the sources. We're kind of getting near the end here a little bit, but I really want to tap your brain and share with the listeners about this one. The book is really an encyclopedia of spy novels, spy journals, movies, academic publications, interviews, personal experiences on the Russian intel services. So I want to ask you, as an expert on these things, what's your favorite spy novel or spy journal you would recommend to people to gain an understanding of how the Russian intelligence services work?
Yeah, of course, some of the best reading is done in Russian, of course. I've done that through my career. I always kept up my Russian language by reading as much as I could in their language. But the ones that come closest, so there's, I mentioned in the book, the novel, The Russia House, and then the movie that was made. The movie is equally good that has Sean Connery in it. It's kind of forgotten, I think, from the late 80s, early 90s. But it shows a Russian spy that comes the closest to some of the Russian penetrations of their services and Russian spies that I was honored to work with in my career. So that I'll save that for the book, let the readers enjoy when they come to that part of the book. I talk about that. You know, when I think about sort of books to read or movies out there, you know, in terms of focus on denied area operations, there's a couple of really good books. One of them is called Billion Dollar Spy by Hoffman. It's about the Adolf Tolkachev case, and I talk about that case in my book. And the other one is called A Secret Life by Ben Weiser. And nowadays, you can get them both on Amazon. I think they're probably 10 bucks each. I used to recommend those to my students that I taught in CIA. I mentioned in the book teaching tradecraft for a good chunk of my career. So those are ones that I taught and encouraged our young officers to read. So I hope I share that with your listeners. Maybe they'll be interested in those reads as well.
Yeah, that's really helpful. And then, you know, we're nearing our end here. Great conversation. But I want to give you just the opportunity for an alibi. You know, what else do Americans, particularly senior military officers, need to know about the Russian intelligence services or Russia writ large?
Well, I think that the first thing I'd say is that whether we recognize them, I make this point throughout the book, whether we recognize them as our primary adversary. Remember, Tom, very early in the book, I talk about the phrase glavny protivnik. You know, the Russians consider us the main enemy. We're the glavny protivnik. And I asked, as a young CIA officer, I mentioned in the book, I asked a Russian once, I said, why are we the GP? like, why are we after 9/11? Why are we the main enemy still? Aren't we, haven't we agreed? Our presidents agreed. We're going to fight, you know, we're going to fight this terrorism worldwide. Can't we work together? Why do your services still consider us the main enemy? And he said, as I mentioned in the book, you were the main enemy right after we defeated the Germans in World War II. You became the main enemy. You are the main enemy. You always will be the main enemy. For the Russian security services, the United States comes first. So for our colleagues in the military, my fellow intelligence officers, always remember that. They've never changed their focus like a laser on the United States. Putin is deathly afraid of democracy and of functioning democracies like the United States, the UK, and our allies. So he can't allow the perception within Russia that you can allow people to choose their leaders for free and democratic elections. That's a horrible threat to him and his regime and the billion-dollar palaces they literally build themselves. Remember why Navalny was killed. He was killed because he exposed the corruption in their endemic to their system. The final thing I'd like to say, if we can touch on Ukraine, Tom, can we come back to Ukraine?
Absolutely. Go there.
You know, Ukraine is an existential fight for freedom. The Ukrainians were attacked by the Russian intelligence services, by their military. I believe very strongly, as I said in my book, we have to do everything we can to support the Ukrainians. I traveled a lot in Ukraine as a young student. I was studying in Rostov on the Don in southern Russia. I traveled a lot into the Donbass. It's very sad for me to see what's become of that that area. That's just a cauldron of violence. And Putin's to blame for all of it. I think that we need to remember that even though we're tired and weary of war, 20 years of war, I've deployed to conflict zones. I know many of your listeners have. I appreciate their service. We have a generation who's been injured, wounded, who've died fighting in wars. It's important that we remember the fight for freedom is still going on. It's happening in Ukraine. As tired as we may be from 20 years of war, we have to support our allies. Churchill, I wrote an article for the Cypher Brief called Echoes of 1940, because I believe there is more we can be doing and we should be doing to help the Ukrainians. As difficult as it is after 20 years of our own war, it's important to support our allies. You know, Churchill had this famous broadcast he gave to the occupied of France after France had fallen, talking about war and how hard war is. And he said, much like I'm sure a lot of Americans feel, and I know the Ukrainians feel, we hope this war is going to end. Churchill said, and I can't do justice to that great orator and defender of democracy that he was, but he gave this famous speech. He said, "Gather strength for the morning will come. Brightly will it shine on the brave and true, kindly upon all who suffered for the cause, gloriously upon the tombs of heroes. Thus will shine the dawn." So the dawn will come. This war will end at some point. And we Americans want to have a clear conscience before history, Tom, that we, the arsenal of democracy, we did our part. We did everything we could to continue to help Ukraine, as we've been doing, as we continue to do in this administration, continue to help them in the fight to defend freedom. So I think that's really important. And that's where the fight against Russian intelligence and all their malign and evil influence in the world, that's where the terms are starkest right now in Ukraine.
Amen. And I think we agree with you 100% here at the Army War College. It's why it's in our classrooms. That's why we're on our fourth year of that integrated research project, to both give back expertise, but also to educate our students as they go through that process of studying that war and understanding it. Well, Sean, thank you for your time and all of the expertise that you have shared today. Well, you and I could truly continue this discussion for many, many more hours. Unfortunately, our time has run out. So I want to thank you, Sean Wiswesser, for joining us on A Better Peace, the War Room podcast. And I look forward to the publication of your terrific book, Tradecraft, Tactics and Dirty Tricks, Russian Intelligence and Putin's Secret War, in April of 2026.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate the opportunity. I appreciate the service of all of your servicemen and women there at Army War College and those that are listening. I appreciate this opportunity to talk about some things I'm very passionate about. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And thanks to all of you for listening. And please send us your comments on this program and suggestions for future programs. If you enjoyed this podcast, I encourage you to subscribe to A Better Peace, leave a rating, and most importantly, tell a friend about the program. From the War Room, I am Tom Spar.
And that concludes our program. Thank you for listening. The views expressed on this podcast reflect those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views, policies, or positions of the U.S. Army or the Department of War. Let us know what you think. Provide us your feedback, comments, or suggestions through our webpage at warroom.com. www.armywarcollege.edu. And have a great day.